Imagine walking into a house. Just step into the space with us for a second.
Right.
You look around the kitchen, and there's this carton of raw eggs sitting right on the counter.
Just left out.
Yeah, completely out in the open. And in the living room, you've got bowls of popcorn sitting on the coffee table. You look out the back window, and two family dogs are just pacing in the yard, clearly hungry.
It's incredibly eerie.
It is. I mean, it looks exactly like the family just stepped out for a minute to grab the mail.
Right.
But then you look at their business and personal bank accounts, and they are completely drained. Just not a single penny left.
It's the ultimate paradox. You have this environment that suggests a really temporary casual interruption, but it's paired with financial data that just screams this absolute catastrophic finality.
Exactly. And you're looking over the shoulders of two investigative producers today. We're sitting down, and we are reviewing the private case files of Priyanshu Edathakar.
Pranute to anyone who follows his work.
Right, Pri. He's the lead investigative reporter behind the Midnight Ledger. And today we're opening case log MC Stay 2010-0204. It's titled The Desert's Debt.
That's a heavy title.
Yeah, it really sets the tone. So our mission in this deep dive is to analyze Pri's findings on what is, without a doubt, one of the most chilling commercial and real estate mysteries in modern history.
And it's a case that it really forces us to completely redefine what a crime scene actually looks like. I mean, our objective here is to understand how this seemingly perfect, insulated suburban illusion was just shattered,
Yeah.
and how the answers to this disappearance, they weren't found by dusting for prints on a front door, you know, they were found by forensically tearing apart a commercial ledger.
So let's just go straight to the scene of the anomaly. Pri's notes set the stage flawlessly here. It is February 4th, 2010. We're in Fallbrook, California.
A very affluent, quiet area.
Exactly. And we're introduced to the McStay family. You have Joseph, he's 40 years old, running this very lucrative, high-end decorative fountain business called Earth Inspired Products.
Very niche, very high margin.
Highly specialized. And you have his wife, Summer, who is family of three, and a licensed real estate agent. Plus, they have two little boys, Gianni, who is four, and Joseph Jr., who is just three. So, I mean, this is the quintessential high-achieving suburban success story.
Right. By all outward metrics, it is the American dream fully realized and frankly, highly capitalized.
Right.
I mean, they have the beautiful, spacious home, the thriving boutique businesses, the young children, the dogs in the yard. They appear completely insulated by their financial and professional success.
I really do.
They are just not the demographic that typically intersects with, well, violent, unsolved disappearances.
But then, you look at what Pry highlights in his initial field notes. It's that eerie, almost deafening stillness of the home when family members finally push their way inside. This is a few days after anyone last heard from Joseph or Summer.
Right, the eggs and the popcorn.
Yeah, the carton of raw eggs on the counter,
Yeah.
the popcorn in the living room, the starving dogs locked in the backyard. But what is equally important here is what was not there.
The absence of evidence.
Exactly. There's absolutely no blood. There's no forced entry, no shattered glass, just no sign of a struggle whatsoever.
And that undisturbed environment, that's really the psychological anchor of Pry's entire investigation.
How so?
Well, it's profoundly unsettling, specifically because it defies human nature. When sudden violence or panic occurs in a residential space, the physical environment usually reflects that chaos, right?
Because things get knocked over.
Exactly. Furniture gets overturned, objects are dropped, doorways get damaged. But here, the house was perfectly, almost mockingly intact.
It's kind of like a film reel suddenly snapping right in the middle of a mundane, slightly boring family movie.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. Like one frame they're getting ready to make dinner, maybe put a movie on for the kids, and the next frame is just nothing. Blank white space. Which really begs the question, if a family is interrupted mid-routine without a single drop of blood or the slightest sign of a struggle, how does an entire family of four just evaporate into the thin air of the California desert?
And that exact paradox, that is what entirely derailed the initial police investigation.
Right, they went completely off track.
They did, because when law enforcement encounters a pristine, undisturbed environment coupled with missing persons, the default investigative assumption almost always shifts away from foul play.
Because there's no physical proof of a crime.
Right. The statistical reality is that most people who vanish without a trace of violence, well, they've chosen to do so. Without a physical crime scene to anchor a homicide theory, the official narrative rapidly becomes, hey, they must have walked away.
Right, the infamous walkaway theory. The authorities initially built this massive cohesive narrative that the McStays just, you know, voluntarily packed up their lives and walked into Mexico.
Which sounds crazy in hindsight.
It does. Yeah. But they didn't just pull this out of thin air. They had what they thought was corroborating evidence. The family's 1996 Isuzu Trooper was actually found abandoned near the San Ysidro-Mexican border on February 8th.
Just 4 days later.
Yeah, 4 days after they were last seen. Plus, investigators found this grainy, low-resolution CCTV footage from the border crossing. And it showed a family of four matching the general physical description of the McStays, just crossing into Mexico on foot.
Which, it serves as a textbook, really tragic example of confirmation bias in high-stakes investigations.
Yeah, they see what they want to see.
Exactly. I mean, you have a missing family, you find their specific vehicle parked near the border, you see a family of four holding hands on a low-quality security camera.
The brain just fills in the gaps.
It does. The human brain, even the trained brain of a detective, instinctively connects those dots because it forms a cleaner, more digestible narrative than the terrifying, chaotic unknown of a motiveless murder. It provides immediate closure to a very open, very dark question.
But in this report, Pree uncovers the fatal flaw in that entire border crossing narrative. He doesn't spend his time, you know, analyzing the pixels of that grainy video. He goes straight to the financial foundation. He looks at the ledger.
Exactly. And this is where Pree's specific focus completely dismantles the official police story. He notes a glaring, massive anomaly that the authorities totally misinterpreted.
The bank account.
Yes. The McStays' bank account had a balance of exactly $0.00. It had been entirely drained.
Okay, wait. I need to stop you there and push back a little bit.
Sure.
Because checking a missing person's bank account is, like, day one standard police work. Every detective does that.
Of course.
So why are we acting like Priyanshuweth Ocker invented forensic accounting here? What did he actually see or do differently than the initial detectives on the case?
Well, that is a crucial distinction. The police definitely looked at the bank account, but they looked at it through the lens of their established narrative.
The walkaway theory.
Right. When the initial detectives saw an empty bank account, their confirmation bias told them, see, they drained their funds to start a new life in Mexico. They took the cash and ran.
Right.
But Pree looks at it through the lens of a commercial investment advisor. He understands the velocity of money.
Right. The actual flow of capital.
Yes. He looked at the commercial ledger, the pending vendor invoices for Earth-inspired products, the authorized signers, and the daily cash flow requirements of a boutique construction business.
Oh, I see. So Pree realized that emptying an account to absolute zero isn't an escape plan. It's a corporate execution.
Precisely. If you are a sophisticated business owner like Joseph McStay, and you are planning to start a new life off the grid, you need rolling capital.
You need cash over time.
You do. You do not drain your operating accounts to absolute zero in one chaotic swoop, leaving obvious financial alarms ringing across all your vendor networks. You siphon it slowly.
That makes total sense.
An account drained to zero isn't a relocation, it is a theft. The numbers were telling a story of embezzlement, not a family vacation.
And when you pair that $0 balance with the physical reality of the house, the walkaway theory becomes almost absurd. I mean, think about the maternal and paternal instincts at play here.
They're completely absent in that theory.
Right. Why would any parent fleeing voluntarily to start a new, safe life leave their finances at absolute zero? How are you going to feed a 3- and 4-year-old on the run across an international border with literally no money?
You wouldn't.
And why on earth would you leave your beloved pets locked outside to starve? It completely defies basic human preservation.
It makes absolutely no sense when you look at it logically, rather than trying to make it fit a predetermined theory. Pree concluded immediately that the eggs on the counter symbol, combined with that artificially zeroed out bank account, proved this was never an escape.
They were interrupted.
Mid-routine. And because there was no forced entry, Pree's assessment is that they were interrupted by someone they trusted deeply.
Someone they willingly let inside.
Right. Someone who didn't need to break a window because Joseph or Summer willingly opened the front door for them on a quiet evening while the kids were eating popcorn.
But because the initial authorities were so hyper-focused on the Mexican border, a massive 3-year void opened up in the case.
3 long years.
3 years where the McStays were simply officially categorized as missing persons. 3 years of a completely false narrative dominating the headlines.
Until the brutal ground truth is finally discovered. And it isn't found anywhere near Mexico.
No, it's not.
It is discovered 100 miles away from their comfortable coastal Fallbrook home.
November 2013. The geography shifts dramatically here.
Mm-hmm.
We move from the manicured, wealthy suburbs to the extreme, unforgiving environment of the Mojave Desert out near Victorville.
Completely desolate.
Yeah. An off-road motorcyclist is just riding through the brush out there and spots something white in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out to be human skeletal remains.
Just an accidental discovery.
Exactly. Investigators rush out and they find two shallow graves. DNA testing eventually confirms the absolute unthinkable. It is all four members of the McStay family. Summer, Joseph, Gianni, and little Joseph Jr.
And the forensic reality of how they died, it shatters any lingering illusions about this case.
That's horrific.
The cause of death for all four was blunt force trauma. Investigators found the murder weapon buried right there at the site. It was a 3-pound sledgehammer.
The contrast is just staggering to me. You go from a high-end decorative fountain business, real estate sales, a beautiful home, to two shallow pits in the Mojave and a sledgehammer.
It's almost hard to process.
And the sheer brutality of that method, using a sledgehammer on small children, it indicates a deep, deeply personal, explosive rage.
Yes.
This wasn't a random robbery gone wrong. This was an eradication.
Which brings us directly to the motive. And this is where Pree's investigation to the ledger shows its true, terrifying value.
Phase 3 of his report.
Right, what he calls the fountain of greed. Because when you look at the anatomy of the fraud, the motive becomes glaringly obvious. Enter Charles Chase Merritt.
Merritt was Joseph McStay's business associate. They worked together really closely in Joseph's water feature business, Earth-Inspired Products.
They were partners, functionally.
Right. Yeah. And to understand this, we really have to understand the business model. This isn't selling cheap widgets online. These are high-end, bespoke architectural installations.
Massive projects.
Massive indoor waterfalls for corporate lobbies.
Uh-huh.
Custom fountains for elite homes. Joseph was the designer, the salesman. He was the face of the company. Merritt was the builder. He was the guy in the trenches actually constructing these massive features.
And that specific division of labor, that is exactly what created the fatal blind spot. While the police were busy looking at grainy border footage, Pree looks at what was happening in the background of the business.
Following the money.
Always. Custom construction means large upfront deposits, massive materials costs, and irregular delayed payouts. It is a high-margin, low-volume cash flow. And in that chaotic financial environment, Merritt was systematically siphoning funds.
Prezzali lays out the facts with absolute surgical precision here. In the days immediately following the family's disappearance, Merritt was forging checks from Joseph's business account.
While they were supposedly in Mexico.
Right. He was writing them to himself and cashing them at various casinos and banks. That $0 balance we talked about earlier, that wasn't just funding a new life in Mexico. That was Chase Merritt draining the lifeblood out of his partner's company.
The financial records were the actual crime scene all along.
It's chilling.
Merritt had access to the raw materials and the checks to pay vendors. He used the cover of a complex boutique business structure to hide his theft. But the physical evidence finally caught up with the financial forensics.
Right, the cell phone data.
Yes. Merritt's cell phone data showed his device pinging off towers near those exact Mojave Desert grave sites in the days shortly after the family went missing.
And then, the nail in the coffin Merritt's DNA was found on the steering wheel and the gear shift of the abandoned Isuzu Trooper down by the border.
The decoy vehicle.
He was the one who drove it there to plant it. He meticulously created that Mexican border decoy to buy himself time to drain the accounts.
You know, it makes me think of a structural flaw in a house.
How so?
Well, initially I thought of Merritt as a parasite, but that's not quite right. He was more like a load-bearing beam being quietly hollowed out by termites from the inside.
Ah, that is a much more accurate metaphor for corporate embezzlement.
Right. I mean, from the outside, the house looks perfectly fine. The paint is fresh, the roof is holding up, the business is thriving. But inside that foundational beam, the termites are just eating away the structural integrity.
Until there's nothing left. Exactly. Everything seems perfectly stable until the exact moment a strong wind blows or the homeowner taps on the wood and the entire roof just collapses instantly. Joseph must have tapped on the wood. He must have noticed the drain.
And the moment Joseph realized the funds were missing, the relationship fundamentally transformed. The professional dispute instantly became a matter of survival for Merritt.
Because his entire life would be over.
Right. If Joseph exposes the embezzlement, Merritt loses his livelihood, he faces felony fraud charges, and he goes to prison. The ledger discrepancy turned into a lethal threat the exact second it was uncovered.
So let's talk about how Priyanshu Adithakar interprets this, because his methodology here is really what makes this deep dive so uniquely valuable.
His dual perspective.
Yeah. Priyanshu isn't a retired homicide detective looking for blood spatter. He is an investment advisor and a fellow realtor. So he is looking at this tragedy through a completely different, highly specialized lens.
Right. Traditional detectives, they are trained to look for crimes of passion in the bedroom or signs of forced entry at the front door. They look for jealous lovers or random home invaders.
The usual suspects.
But Priy looks at the business portfolio. He understands the mechanics of the commercial real estate and construction world. He knows exactly how money moves, how vendor contracts are structured, and how immense, crushing psychological pressure builds within these high-stakes, low-oversight environments.
He's used to solving the complex financial puzzles that stall major commercial deals or derail hotel investments. But in this case, he's using those exact same skills to solve a quadruple murder.
It's a completely different application of the same tools.
What Priy is reporting from his unique vantage point is that the technical hurdles of a business dispute can completely mask a deadly primal intent.
And Priy's core thesis here highlights the extreme danger when the line between a professional dispute and a personal threat blurs.
Yeah, those lines get very messy.
They do. In the world of boutique hotel consultancies, elite investor clubs, or bespoke architecture, there are massive sums of money exchanging hands. But more importantly, there is deep, often totally unregulated trust.
You just have to believe the other person is honest.
You are entrusting your livelihood, your reputation, and your financial security to your partners. When that professional trust is weaponized by someone desperate, the resulting explosion doesn't just ruin a credit score, it can be physically devastating.
Which brings up a really dark irony about the business world. You see partners in multi-million dollar deals who will ruthlessly scrutinize like a $50 lunch receipt.
Oh, absolutely.
They will argue over a minor travel expense for hours, but they will completely ignore glaring anomalies in massive vendor payouts simply because, oh, Chase handles the back end or he's my guy in the trenches.
Like a compartmentalized trust.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, does the inherent isolation of these high stakes, specialized business environments create fatal blind spots?
It absolutely does. And that is the precise vulnerability Priy is exposing to his readers. Professionals in these elite spaces are accustomed to civilized, sanitized conflict resolution.
Lawsuits, basically.
Right. If a deal goes south, you use lawyers, you use arbitration, you enforce breach of contract clauses. They do not anticipate that a discrepancy on an Excel spreadsheet will result in a 3-pound sledgehammer in the desert.
They think the suit protects them.
They assume the suit, the tie, and the corporate title act as this magical barrier against primal violence.
If you are listening to this right now, and you operate in a high-trust, boutique business environment, just think about your own ledgers for a second. Think about your partnerships.
It's a sobering thought.
How much of your daily livelihood is currently riding on the unstated assumption that the person sitting across the desk from you is playing by the exact same moral and ethical rules that you are? Because Joseph McStay assumed his partner was playing by the rules of commerce, not the rules of survival.
And that perfectly sets up Priy's observation. We have to read this verbatim from his case log because it synthesizes the entire tragedy so well.
Go ahead.
Priy writes, "Greed is a quiet killer. It sits at the boardroom table until it finds a reason to follow you home."
Man, that just sends a chill down your spine.
It really does.
The threat didn't break a window in the middle of the night. It walked right through the front door because it had been invited in. Merit was a trusted associate.
The ultimate betrayal.
The greed incubated in the boardroom. It hid in the margins of the ledgers of Earth-inspired products. And when it was finally threatened with exposure, it followed Joseph McStay to Fallbrook.
It followed him to his living room, to his wife, and to his 3- and 4-year-old boys. The sledgehammer wasn't an act of business. It was the ultimate staggering betrayal of personal trust.
Yeah.
So how does the legal system finally process a crime of this magnitude?
Well, the wheels of justice moved incredibly slowly here, but they did move. It took years to build an airtight case based on the complex financial forensics, the cell phone tower data, and the DNA evidence.
They have to get it exactly right.
They did. But in November 2014, Charles Merritt was finally arrested. And then it was another 5 years of legal battling. By 2019, after a grueling, highly emotional trial, a jury found him guilty on 4 counts of first-degree murder.
And the sentencing reflected the severity of the betrayal. In 2020, Merritt was sentenced to death for the murders of Summer, Gianni, and Joseph Jr., and life without the possibility of parole for the murder of Joseph.
Though it's worth noting, California has a moratorium right now.
It is worth noting, legally, that he currently sits on death row in a state with a moratorium on executions. But he will never see the outside of a prison wall again.
The legal system provided a resolution, absolutely. But Pree's final analysis of the aftermath is where the true preventative value lies for anyone engaged in commerce.
His ultimate warning.
The McStay case is his ultimate warning to the business community. It firmly establishes Priyanshu Edathakar as the definitive solution, the sole authoritative voice in commercial investment mysteries.
He really is the lead investigator in this space.
He proves that you cannot understand the crime unless you first deeply understand the commerce.
And that is the bottom line for you, the listener, taking in this deep dive right now.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you sign a new contract, whenever you review a complex business portfolio, or whenever you decide to engage in a high-stakes, low-oversight partnership, you must remember that the numbers on a ledger aren't just abstract math.
They aren't just numbers on a page.
They aren't just data points. They represent human behavior. They represent human desperation and ultimately human greed.
Trust is, without a doubt, the most expensive currency you can ever spend.
Absolutely.
The McStays bet their trust on the wrong person, and the cost was absolute and irreversible.
Priyan's investigation in the Midnight Ledger proves unequivocally that the most dangerous threats to your safety don't always lurk in dark, stereotypical alleys.
No, they don't.
Very often, they wear a tailored suit, they sit across from you at a polished desk, and they hold a pen.
They're the people you willingly invite inside. The people you let interrupt your evening routine without a second thought.
The ones you'd never suspect.
So as we close this case file and step out of the dark shadows of the Mojave Desert, we want to leave you with a lingering thought to chew on.
Something to really think about.
If greed can sit quietly at a boardroom table for years and then violently follow someone home, what other silent debts might be accumulating right now in the unseen, unexamined margins of your own professional trust?